Hey guys, welcome back to the Love That Lasts podcast. This is Jeff, and we really hope that you're enjoying the show as much as we enjoy creating it. And this week, the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries is back, and we think you guys are going to really dig this episode, so sit back and enjoy.
Our show is supported by the Love That Lasts experience. This experience is a new approach to helping couples tackle the tough questions in marriage. To learn more about this amazing marriage resource, visit lovethatlasts.co. lovethatlasts.co.
Today, we're talking all about identity. And immediately after beginning this episode, I realized that I had bitten off way more than I can chew. But that's never stopped me before. So I'm just going to charge into this episode and share the insights that I have learned and hope that it's helpful to somebody. And if you're wondering why on earth we chose identity for one of the episodes of a marriage podcast, it's because of this crazy idea that I had literally never thought of until I sat down with Dr. Les and Leslie Parrott.
If you're consumed with yourself for reasons of insecurity, that's as, you know, as narcissistic as being consumed with yourself because you're thinking you're all that. So you have to have the capacity to just be accurately assessing who you are, your gifts, your quirks, your flaws, and aware of all of it, the whole package, and then set it aside so you can be consumed with another person.
In that clip, which is a mere 27 seconds long, Leslie Parrott says five little words that stuck out in my mind.
Accurately assessing who you are.
But how many of us can actually do that? Can anyone accurately assess who they are? I mean, I almost feel like we can't. And here's why. So remember in last week's episode how we talked about communication being like a knot in really, really long hair? Well, identity is absolutely the same. Identity is not just what we think we are. It's also what we are told that we are. And somewhere in between the thinking and the telling, our lines get crossed up, and we don't know if the thing we think we are is actually the thing we thought about ourselves, or just something someone else told us about ourselves. Do you know what I mean? So in my particular story, I am the baby of five kids. And as a kid, if I did something bratty, it was inevitable that some adult would say, "Oh, it's because Melanie's the baby." And in a way, they would reinforce my behavior by not punishing me the same way that they would punish the firstborn child, because I'm the baby. And so while I may not have identified as the baby, I was treated as the baby by other people who identified me as such. I mean, it's super weird, but there's no doubt in my mind that having the "but she's the baby" excuse actually reinforced a cycle of me acting different in certain situations. So then, in a way, I actually became the baby. And as stupid as it sounds, when Seth and I first got married, my identity of being the baby reared its ugly head in a way that neither one of us expected. And it was something that we really actually had to deal with.
You know, I was the youngest kid of five kids, so I was like essentially free to do what I wanted.
Here's me and Seth in the car again.
I didn't have a ton of rules as a kid, and like that has a good side where I could go, "Oh, look at all these things I'm interested in and I'm whatever." But conversely, a really bad side where you think the world owes you something. You're the youngest, you're the baby. Right. Where's my Christmas present? Where's my birthday present on my brother's birthday? Right? Like,
so you felt entitled to a lot of things?
Yeah, like I grew up thinking like, yeah, I'm the baby. Everybody look at me. Like, why aren't you looking at me? Like,
well, it's
this
not so much you thought.
Yeah, it wasn't that I was intentionally thinking it.
It wasn't a conscious thought. That was just, that was your paradigm. That is how you viewed the world.
It was exactly how I viewed the world. And the reason it made such an impact on our marriage was that my identity of being the most important person on the planet did not fly with Seth. And when he confessed to looking at pornography and lying to me, it did two things. The first thing was that it exposed a terrible truth about myself. And that truth was that I am, in fact, just a normal human being. People can lie to me. They do lie to me. And secondly, it proved that my identity of being a baby was no longer appropriate as a wife.
A huge part of you, yeah, your ego was being attacked.
Yeah, and but it's like, it was a good, is a good thing.
Well, you didn't think so. In retrospect, it's a good thing because it's changing you, but you obviously were fighting tooth and nail to keep your homeostasis, to keep your world like it was. That's what you were, your ego didn't want to die.
Yeah, and that's, I think, so essentially it's like I'm battling this big identity crisis at the same time my marriage is falling apart, at the same time I have two tiny kids. So I think that for me is why I think it felt so bad, you know, or so intense or crazy or whatever.
So my childhood identity of being a spoiled little brat snuck into my marriage and threw a big fat temper tantrum. But identity is so different for every person. So in this next story, I'm going to bring back an old friend, my old friend, Nicole, and her husband, Charlie, who you'll remember from episodes number 2 and episodes number 6, where they talked about music in church and then the expectation to have kids. But in this episode, they're talking about a struggle that started way back when Nicole was growing up.
I think that, like, for most of my life, like, I've always had responsibilities and couldn't really do me, like, do my own thing. So college came, and I was still at home. Like, I was living at home and commuting to UW, and
she really wanted to be on campus.
Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted stuff like that. Like, I wanted to experience that. I wanted to not be responsible, I think. Like, I wanted to go be crazy and have fun. And I never did.
Nicole grew up with a wonderful and loving family. She is the oldest of 4 kids and was, of course, treated like the oldest. She was expected to help with her younger siblings, to do good in school and to be a good role model. But eventually that cycle of expecting her to act a certain way and then rewarding her when she did snuck its way into her identity and became an external expectation as well as an internal rule that Nicole feels made her miss out on certain things in life.
I've never had a chance to really be on my own and figure out who I am in the context of, like not in the context of being a wife or being a daughter or like I was ever able to just find myself. And so I think maybe that's what was playing into me not wanting to get married.
Nicole shared that she has memories all the way back to first grade of never wanting to get married and never wanting to have kids. But then Charlie came along. He asked Nicole out, and she said no. He asked her out again, and she said no. And over the span of 4 months, he asked her out 6 different times before she finally said yes.
It was really weird, because I definitely wanted to marry her. Like, I bought a ring. Mm-hmm. 6 months into our relationship. I want to say November. Mm-hmm. November. I carried it around with me a good bit. Not always, because I knew it wasn't going to be for a while, but mm-hmm. There was definitely times where I had it and I wanted to, and then I just didn't.
Something about Nicole and Charlie's story stands out to me as being identity-driven. And maybe it doesn't feel like that to you, but to me it seems like Nicole's life and responsibilities have always felt really heavy to her. But I also think that she's been taking the expectations of others and holding so tightly to them that if she falters even a little bit, she might feel like a failure. And I mean, I am totally guessing here, but when I contrast Nicole's life to my own, I can see where I've had people speaking into my own life telling me what I should and shouldn't do, but I didn't hold on to their ideas tightly enough to feel responsible for them. So they didn't shape me the way that they shaped Nicole. Does that make sense? But the worst part of this whole story to me is that Nicole doesn't seem to be out of this space in her life. And I say the worst part because she's my friend, whom I love dearly. And it's hard to see someone that you love struggling.
What do you feel like you missed?
I feel like I missed... I don't know. Like, I feel like I missed being young. Right? Like...
life experiences, partying. Yeah.
Well, like I feel like that's, I don't know, not part of growing up, but like that's part of getting to be a college student and getting to be in your early 20s. I hung out with a good crowd throughout high school, so we didn't do that kind of stuff. I don't know. I don't know what I feel like I missed. I get restless when I think about it, mm-hmm. I guess. But I don't know what it is that I feel like I'm missing, besides being that, maybe it's being that carefree, like not having that weight.
We're going to talk more about identity after a quick word from our sponsors.
Our show is supported by 31 Creative Ways. Jeff and I wrote this. It's a really cool book for him and for her, and it's a way to bring back beauty, joy, and vibrancy to your relationship. We wanted to do it because right after Cannon was born, it's really hard with a newborn to put each other first, and so we started to do really simple things like writing 5 things that I love about Jeff on the bathroom mirror. And it totally made our day, and it brought us closer together, and we realized, hey, like, even though we have a newborn, we are in it and we love each other and you come first. So we wrote this book for him and her. Each day covers a topic or theme that is crucial to a healthy relationship and includes a challenge to put that theme into action, as well as providing a section at the end of each day to record your thoughts, memories, and fun details. To find out more, visit 31creativeways.com.
The thing that strikes me the most that I've realized in this process is, like, here's me, Seth, and Matt again. The way that I've understood myself for so many years really affected the way that I interacted in our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about, like, things like, how does personal identity impact you personally, but more importantly, how does it impact your relationships? What do you think as a therapist?
Well, think about it this way, like, personal identity, ego, all this stuff. When you get married, it's like, okay, I am this person. I'm married to this person. We expect them to change or whatever. And think about, like, if you were a block of gold and I was a block of silver and we're just rubbing against each other all the time, right? You're not going to stop being gold. I'm not going to stop being silver. And there's trouble, right? So that can kind of represent, like, well, I'm not changing. I expect the other person to change, and that just doesn't work, right? So earlier I was talking about, like, you know, having your ego die is really what it takes to have a sacrificial, healthy relationship, and then kind of let it die and then let it rise out of the ashes together as a couple. Does that make sense?
So are you saying that I can't have a personal identity? I can only have a marital identity?
Nope, I'm not saying that. Let the individual, independent identity die when you get married, and then both of you can create a shared identity. You know, yeah, you don't do one without, you know, it's not Seth if it's not
so
Melanie.
Is it like half individual, half marital?
Yes, to put it simply, yes.
To put it simply. I don't know if you can tell, but I don't really buy that idea. In fact, I think it's really terrible. Apart from me being a block of gold, I mean, that part's true. But the rest, nah. I will not kill my identity to make a new identity in my marriage. It's not going to happen. But what I can do is examine the parts of my identity that might not be true, or that might be really damaged, or that might be hurting other people, and work on those instead. But I sure as heck am not going to kill anything. I mean, seriously. And again, because identity is such a gigantic topic, I can only speak to what I've experienced in my own life. So let's go back for a second, and I'm going to share something that's embarrassing but also insightful at the same time. Now, I know that there are some people I went to high school with who listened to this podcast and who knew me like 15 years ago, and that's rad. But I didn't stay friends with anyone from high school, and do you want to know why? Because back in high school, I was a total bitch. You heard me right. I was unkind, I was selfish, I was rude to people, I picked on people, and I didn't care about anybody but myself. I had absolutely no loyalty except for a handful of my friends, and even then, after high school, we completely lost touch. And for a long time, that made me totally sad, because I loved my friends. But I had changed so much that the things that my friends were into were no longer the things that I was into. And even worse, the people that I had treated poorly still think I'm a total bitch today. And so I was in such a weird place after high school where I essentially lost all of my childhood friends and then made an entire new set of friends that shared my current values and beliefs. And that's great, right? Well, it's not so great if you see someone that you went to high school with who didn't like you, right? But it's even more awkward if you see someone that you went to high school with and you're with your husband who has only known you in this new and different identity. I mean, you get what I'm saying? And the more that I think about it, the more it feels like the way that I behaved in high school was just a phase. A really long phase, if you ask me, but it sort of was, wasn't it? But isn't everything? I mean, even now, I'm a mom with 3 young kids. This particular time in my life is literally just a phase. The way my children speak to me right now, the way my children respond to me right now, the way I speak and respond to them, this is all a phase. And it will not look the same when they are 18, 21, and 22 years old. So here's me and Dr. Dan Siegel talking about the ways that my identity has changed within my marriage.
When I met my husband, I was 19, and now I'm 32. I'm not really very similar. I mean, there's similar things about me, but a lot has changed. I mean, this is not a question I was planning on asking you, so forgive me for the, like, jumbled.
This is the process is the content. This is good. I can't move at all.
Yeah, so what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that. I think it's a really important reflection you're making, very mindsightful reflection. And, you know, I think the idea is that when we take a pause and think, who am I? It's very natural to think, I am this. And it has a kind of noun-like quality, like it's fixed and it's like you're holding a rock in your hand, right? So it's very natural to think that way. But when you look at, even just from a brain point of view, how the brain develops throughout the lifespan, from the even before you're born, the brain is growing and changing, and it grows throughout elementary school and middle school and high school. But then it continues to grow in the mid-20s, and it continues to grow throughout the entire lifespan. Now, once you say that, you go, well, what's the relationship between my identity? When I say, this is me, Melanie, or this is me, Dan, what's that identity? Then you say, well, it's from your mind. You say, well, okay, well, how does the mind relate to the brain? The mind is not the same as the brain, but it uses the neural connections, these synaptic connections and the many ways they change across the lifespan to continually grow and develop and emerge. And it's profoundly interconnected with other people and our planet. So we have one side of us that wants to think it's fixed like a rock. But then we have the science reality, which is that we're always growing and changing from the brain point of view, from the mind point of view, from the relationship point of view. And so when you realize that, it can make some people really upset because they want to say, I want to figure it out. I want to know exactly who I am. Well, there are a lot of people who try to live that way, but they shut themselves down. When instead, if you accept that you are constantly in a state of growth and what's called emergence, then you say, yes, of course, I'm 32 now. I'm different than I was when I was 19. You know, even if I sat in a closet for all those years, I'd probably be different. But I'm also having different experiences, and experiences shape me. And then how I'm shaped shapes how I interpret those experiences, which then in turn changes the experiences that then change who I am, et cetera, et cetera. So, and our relationships are profoundly a part of how we emerge. We don't just emerge from our brains. We emerge also from our connections with other people. And this is why, for me, it's so important. Like, for example, this next book I wrote that'll come out soon called Mind, I really try to emphasize the point that the mind emerges not just from what's up in the head, the brain, but from the entire body, but it's also not limited to the body. It's happening between us, like what's happening between me and you right now or people listening to us. And so when you relax into the emergence of the mind as being fully embodied and fully relational, then it gets actually quite exciting, and you can move beyond a belief you may have had before that things are fixed like a rock and say, wow, I'm participating in this ride of my life. How do I optimize this experience rather than how do I lock onto this rock noun-like view of who I am?
I mean, I think I've always been aware of my identity. And you may know this.
Here's our producer, Matt, again.
In the philosophy of identity, I think it's always been interesting. Is it something that you bring and assert, or is it a reflexive thing of what people say about you and how they experience you? And I've always felt a little bit like I know my identity exists in the way other people see me.
Right.
I've always been aware of that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just aware. If people think I'm fun or funny or whatever, then I just am that more,
right.
Basically.
Right.
So when Matt talked about the idea of identity as being something that you either bring and assert yourself or being the way that others experience you, something stuck out to me. And it was this idea that I hadn't quite figured out how to articulate in the moment, but it will make sense in a minute. So just listen to this clip.
You know, my mom and dad raised me, and I was with my mom the majority of the time, and she still has a very confident, like, oh, I don't fly on planes while I get sick. I don't like this because it makes me feel bad. I don't do this because X, Y, and Z. So as a child, I learned all of those things and thought, that is my identity. I don't travel well. I'm afraid of everything. And right, that's what I learned. That's what I thought my structure and identity was. Mm-hmm. And then when we got married, that was immediately challenged with, you're not from here. We fly back to South Carolina, or we drove to meet your family. And all these things. And so then I'm immediately faced with this, like, well, wait, I'm supposed to not like this, but I like it. I'm supposed to hate hotels, but I enjoy this hotel. What's happening? Right. Mm-hmm. So it was this weird like shift of all the things you have stated that you don't like. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden you're enjoying them and you have to square that off.
In this clip, there are three very different things trying to be communicated at one time. And it took me a while to figure out what they were. The first thing is that I didn't understand that I was actually taking on my mother's identity as my own. Secondly, I was learning through experience that my own identity is very different than my mom's in some aspects, like travel and food. And then the third thing is the struggle that ensued once I realized these two things. I felt completely unable to act in a way that honored my identity because for the previous 21 years, I had practiced a form of my mother's identity and really had no clue how to be me. And that caused a lot of confusion and also some unforeseen guilt.
In families, it's really hard if you come from a family with a fixed mindset. When you break out into that having a growth mindset, there's some sense of abandonment, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, you're going to talk to your mom who has a fixed mindset about traveling or this or that or hotels, like, oh, how great it was. You know, we went to Europe and we traveled here and it was, you know, this hotel was awesome. It's you're not going to resonate as much as you used to with your mom. Right. And then some of that feels like, oh, I'm abandoning it. You know,
it mm-hmm. feels really challenged. It's constantly challenged because mm-hmm. then I'll say, oh, I'm so excited. We're going to do this. And she go, oh, that I would hate mm-hmm. that. And then you're like, oh, should I yeah. hate it too?
A good example of what do you call it? Fixed mindset and growth mindset would just be your approach probably to food would be a really good
oh, yeah.
way to analyze that. So there's a lot of people who say, I don't like, and then they have a list of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then there's other people that are interested in trying new foods or even revisiting foods that they thought they didn't like mm-hmm. and seeing if they can add it back now. Because, mm-hmm. you know, theoretically, and for most people, or for me at least, I taste things a lot different than I did when I was something I didn't like when I was a kid. I thought I didn't like, and mm-hmm. it turns out I do. Maybe mm-hmm. my tastes have changed, my experiences, or my frame, or you know, even the taste buds physiologically have changed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you grew up in a place, especially where it was the food, it was of a very fixed mindset, and then you'd start talking about sushi. Oh, right. Oh, Mr. Oh, yeah. Fancy Pants. What do you got, caviar? Yeah.
And then you get chastised.
So let's learn a little bit more about fixed mindsets and growth mindsets.
And then when we take the idea that this notion of a noun-like view and look at some of the research, for example, of Ellen Langer, who studies a thing called mindful learning at Harvard University, or Carol Dweck, who studies a related process, this idea of fixed mindset versus growth mindset at Stanford, you know, what those studies reveal is that when you have a fixed view, it makes learning less enjoyable. That's Ellen Langer's work. When you have a fixed view of who you are, it actually makes it so you're less likely to move forward in life and achieve your potential. You go, whoa, wait, why is that? Well, because if you say, well, I have this amount of intelligence, and then you come up with a challenge that makes it so it's really, really difficult, what research has shown is you tend to back away from further challenges. You don't want anything literally challenging your noun-like view of who you are. But if in contrast to that fixed noun view, which turns into pessimism actually, you have an optimistic growth mindset view, which says, hey, if this challenge is here and it's difficult, I need to put in more effort. Because my view of reality is that people grow and emerge given the challenges they have. So I see this challenge not as a sign of something wrong with me, but as an opportunity to learn more. Good. So the same challenge by a person with a growth mindset that turns to growth in a fixed mindset person turns to despair. And so you can see it's not just even about learning things like knowledge or a skill like playing an instrument or a foreign language, but it's also about the very notion that we can change. So people with fixed mindsets, they think the self is fixed and anything that affronts their personality is like a despairing view of their inadequacies. Whereas the same kind of challenge for a growth mindset, they say, oh, yeah, I don't really think that's a part of my personality I think I want to keep. Let me work on it. You know, it's like completely different. So this, I think, is incredibly...
What do you think about the idea of like your marriage actually having an identity?
That's pretty interesting, I guess.
I know, I thought of that.
Good job. Your marriage, you know, oh, what are you? Well, I think we've talked about before. It's like, oh, yeah, we're the like couple with tattoos.
We're so cool.
And there's like a zillion of those, right? So who cares? But we think it's cool, I guess. So that's some sort of identity. Like,
it's probably harder to know what your marital identity is as a unit, but I think it's relatively obvious to other people. So I think me and my wife are completely different, but I know most people in the world see us as a package. Oh, they are this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to me, I feel like a very much an individual in my marriage with another individual.
When I was trying to explain this idea, the three of us got off track really quickly and didn't get to the heart of what I meant. So I'm going to interject here. The idea that your marriage has its own identity hit me when I was examining the patterns of my own marriage and realizing that Seth and I function in a particular way that we have established over the years. And in that pattern, there are distinct aspects of our relationship that we unknowingly look to make sure that things are okay. And if those aspects were to change, we would feel lost. For example, Seth likes to be silly, like a lot. And if he changed that all of a sudden and wanted to be serious all of the time, not only would his identity change, but an enormous part of the identity of our entire marriage would also shift right along with it. And just like when I was talking about realizing that I was trying to have the identity of my mother and how that was weird and unsettling, that's what happens when the identity of marriage shifts. And this happens a lot more than we might think. Imagine someone getting Alzheimer's or having a traumatic brain injury that changes the way that person behaves. That tends to also change the way that their relationships function, and this changes the identity within the relationship. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to weather that storm. And honestly, I am just realizing this, that when Seth confessed to me about lying and pornography and all of that stuff, it was an instantaneous shift in the identity of our marriage. And it was an insane storm that we had to walk through if we wanted to make it through together. I talked to Dr. Dan Siegel about some of these ideas, and he shared some really great insight with me.
He and I went through a time when we had been married for about 5 years that was really, really hard. And I wanted to divorce him. And I thought that's what I was going to do. And sort of a light bulb went off in my head. And I said, you know what? I don't want to. We had kids already at the time. And I was like, I don't want to do that to my children. And he and I both decided we're just going to like bear down as hard as we can on this and see if we can make it work. And so, you know, I'm sure that sometimes that fails and it doesn't succeed. But in our case, it succeeded. And our determination to make our marriage work has made it so much better now than it was back then. It was that determination to stick together. It required us to look at ourselves and look at one another with new eyes. And our relationship it's hard to explain, but the connection that we have now is so much greater than the connection we had before.
Can I ask you a question about that? Do you sense in how you define yourself now versus before the troubled times when you thought about getting divorcing is different? And if so, how would you describe the difference?
It's very different. Before, I think I was exactly what you were saying. I had a fixed mindset. I knew I could only take so much. I knew it, like it was the truth somehow. But when I was put into the situation where I had to stretch my boundaries, and I realized if I don't stretch my boundaries, the result will just be divorce. Then I stretched my boundaries, and it is night and day transformation in myself of I can do different things than I thought I could do.
There you go. Well, so you really feel like you're allowing yourself to enter this growth mindset. You know, what's amazing about the growth mindset is does the amount of energy you feel in your experience differ now?
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, my husband's a therapist, so I would sort of get secondhand therapy knowledge from him, and we would talk about these different concepts. And the more I stretched my boundaries, because for the longest time I thought I'm an artist, I'm a singer, that's what I do. I was in orchestra, I'm a musician, and so I was never considering myself to be smart. I was just like, oh, I'm artsy, right? These are different categories. And once I let myself step into a space of like, no, I can understand bigger concepts than I thought, and we can talk about these therapeutic things intelligibly, and it's I don't know, stepping into that space and not diminishing my own worth has really brought a huge personal change. I mean, I genuinely feel like I'm not the same person I was. And a lot of it is due to that conflict, which caused me to have to grow. But it was, again, it was a choice. I could have chose to not grow.
Mm-hmm. From those conflicts that we can learn to adapt to and learn from, we get stronger. I mean, some people have conflicts and they feel helpless and it crushes them. So you know, it is really all about how you approach what life gives you.
I feel like Dr. Dan Siegel wrapped that up so beautifully. And for some reason, it reminded me of this little nugget from my interview with Mike McCarg, aka Science Mike, back in episode number 5, The Science of Love. I think you're going to understand why I feel like this fits into this episode. Just take a listen.
Whatever. Because I feel like I'm such a different personality from you. I always set myself apart from people who are like really smart because I'm not a book type lady. I'm feelings all the way and music and art. And so I think it's really fascinating to sort of pick your brain about what you think, like what would you want to hear about marriage? Let's say you were just going to get married and you're engaged and finally, yay. What did you wish someone had told you? And what is bad advice?
Ooh, those are really good. First of all, as a society, we overemphasize the importance of verbal acuity and technical intelligence with intelligence in general. And science would cleanly reveal that a tremendous intelligence and, frankly, brain capacity is required for creative work, and that it is actually a more integrative way of thinking than really rational thinking. So as a born male feminist, I would just say, I am not smarter than you. And you have been conditioned by a culture to say that, and I just hope you don't believe it.
Thank you.
Sorry.
I'm learning to not believe it, which is a very exciting journey.
Yes. But I can't. Call me in 2 years. I want to hear about that.
I hope you understand why I put that clip in there. And I feel like it's the perfect way to bring this all back around to the very beginning. I mean, identity is so much more than our religion, the things we're into, the color of our skin, or even our gender. Identity is like a spaghetti junction. You know, in big cities where the highways all cross over each other, and it's like a big crazy mess. Identity can make us feel things that aren't true. It can cause us to act in ways that we don't even believe in. Identity can chain us to the ground, but it can also set us free. But not if we don't think about it and examine it just a little bit. Because it is hidden and sensitive and confusing and convoluted. But hey, let's all have a growth mindset about identity, shall we?
Our show is produced by Matt Carter, edited and sound designed by Melanie Steadley. Special thanks to executive producer Craig Gross and StrongerMarriages.com.
Next week, Alyssa and I will be back at our kitchen table talking about faith, culture, and answering your questions. So see you then.